Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Briefing. I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn, joined by editor David Horowitz and political correspondent Carrie Keller-Lynn. Hello to you both.
Hey, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
The reality TV show that we call the Israeli Knesset has just gotten even more dramatic. We will dive in and discuss different scenarios. Also, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's court case has had some plot twists of its own. What's going on there? And finally, we'll hear about our first ever TOI at 10 live event that is going to launch on Tuesday night. Carrie, let's start with you. Break down for us what exactly is happening right now with Meretz. It's still pretty much a cliffhanger, right? It's not the end of the government, or is it the end of the government, or the end of Meretz? What is going on here?
It's actually very unclear to a lot of people what is going on, because the member of Knesset in question, MK Ghaida Rinawi Zarabi, hasn't been clear herself what she expects out of the situation. So let me take you back to last Thursday. Shortly after we released the podcast, Meretz MK Ghaida Rinawi Zarabi made a dramatic announcement that she, too, is leaving the coalition. So she's an interesting character. She was elected on Meretz's slate, but she didn't grow up in the Meretz party. She was placed there. And she's never really been comfortable in Meretz. In fact, she's long been a thorn in the side of the Meretz party. She, this January, torpedoed an important piece of legislation. And so Meretz and the coalition had actually tried to move her out. They had offered her this lucrative position to be consul general in Shanghai, which hasn't come through yet. It was supposed to go through this summer. And on Thursday, she says, "I don't want Shanghai. I don't want the coalition. I personally, my values do not align with the coalition." She has a problem, she cited, with Israeli police's behavior on Al-Aqsa, the Temple Mount, during the month of Ramadan, where there were lots of clashes. She cited Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood in Jerusalem that's long been in contention. She also cited the funeral of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, during which there was confrontation between the Israeli police and funeral mourners. And she said that I'm out of the coalition. And the next question was, you know, what's going to happen? and that's been the biggest issue since, because no one really knows. There are a lot of scenarios. She brought the coalition down to 59 seats rather than the 60 it was at. It has lost its parity. It is now at a minority. And there's a real possibility that the government could be toppled. How so? There is a way for the government to end if opposition parties bring and a simple majority of MK support a bill to dissolve the government this coming Wednesday. And lots of eyes are on her as to whether or not she would support this measure. Now, where do we stand? Rinawi Zarabi has come out and said that she does not want this government necessarily to fall because the alternative is worse. However, she does not support this government. So this kind of puts us in this where to go, where not to scenario. Sources say it's unlikely that she will support dissolution of the Knesset on Wednesday, so this might not be an immediate threat to the coalition. She's meeting later today with both Foreign Minister Yair Lapid and her party leader Nitzan Horowitz, who she has not met with yet since she made this announcement on Thursday, because the relations are reportedly very bad between the two. And we'll see if we come to some sort of resolution, which would mean that either she would support the Knesset from the outside, she would rejoin the coalition, or she would quit her seat, which is an option that is unlikely, but also being floated right now.
Now, David, she's not the only MK right now who says that she doesn't necessarily support the coalition, but definitely does not want to have the alternative. And so we also have, the Joint Arab List in this kind of situation. Do we know whether they would support dissolving the Knesset at this point?
Well, the Joint Arab List, the Joint List, which is six strong, is an opposition party. And in theory, I think they're looking at their polls. Their polls are pretty good. They may feel that elections would work well for them. They might, they've said last week when there was a tentatively planned vote to dissolve the Knesset, they had said that they would have supported it, but Likud decided not to bring it because it didn't think it had the numbers. This week, the Joint List has been saying that it will bring a motion to begin the process of dissolving the Knesset. You've got this very curious, you know, all the various parties, and I would go even further, I'd say even all the people within the various parties are all making feverish calculations about where certain processes would leave them, would leave their parties and would leave them. There's a kind of collective ego process going on here. All these self-interested individuals who have long since forgotten that they're really supposed to be representing their constituencies and their publics, all making their very naked personal calculations. It's just astonishing to me. I mean, we talked about, Carrie's talked about the Meretz Knesset member who resigned from the coalition and who ever since resigning has basically, it has belatedly dawned upon her apparently that if she quits the coalition, then the people they're opposing will get into power, quite possibly led by Benjamin Netanyahu. And so she said, oh, well, that would be much worse than the current coalition. So you ask yourself, well, why didn't you think of that before you quit the coalition? And by the way, if you're not happy representing this coalition, why stay in the Knesset? You won your seat for Meretz. If you're not happy doing what Meretz wants you to do, then resign from the Knesset and they can put somebody in who represents what the voters thought that they were voting for. I mean, it's an extraordinary process. It's not surprising because Israeli politics is so dismayingly, depressingly selfish and self-centered on the part of the politicians. But I think psychologically, I think her resignation and just, you know, the sheer incompetence of the coalition, where the prime minister's own party, you know, he was unable to choose loyalists who could remotely, reliably be expected to support him. I think people have just given up in a situation where almost everybody, or basically everybody, could kill this coalition. I think everybody in it has just concluded that it's a lost cause, that one way or another, these people are so disparate, they're all so selfish, their interests are so utterly contradictory that there's no hope. And now we're in the stage where they're all trying to work out, well, how do I come out of this with a job, not destroyed politically forever? And we're watching the death throes. I don't know how long they're going to take. Could be just a few days, could be a few weeks. And by the way, there is a country to govern, a country in a very, very challenging security situation with lots of economic challenges. We don't talk about this enough, this disappearance of anything between the people who are having a really hard time and the people who are having a wonderful time. You might call that the middle class, but I don't think that quite catches it. You know, the inequalities that are coming to a head in Israel, where tech is flying and everything else, and I'm talking about things like teaching and nursing and real essentials, everybody else in those other worlds are being left behind, can't afford housing and so on. There's real stuff that needs to be legislated and governed and listened to, instead of which you've got, you know, 120 Knesset members. I'm sure there's some good people in there. I'm sure there's lots of good people in there, but they're not governing the country and they're not opposing the government of the country on substantive issues. It is all ego and naked interest. And, you know, there's legislation for funding for scholarships for ex-soldiers. Is that being discussed on its merits? Is anything being discussed on its merits by our politicians at the moment? Really not. I think that was a bit of a diatribe, so I'm going to stop.
I'm glad you're telling us how you really feel, but let's continue on with the cult of personality. And in Likud, the Likud number 2, Yuli Edelstein, has issued really what is definitely a bold statement. On Saturday, he called for the opposition faction to hold, oh my God, leadership primaries if its leader, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, cannot form a government, which he hasn't been able to do in this current Knesset. And if the ruling coalition collapses, is it even in the realm of possibility that there will be some kind of primary in Likud?
So it's a call he made on Saturday. It's a strong call. It's not the first call even made by Yuli Edelstein the past year. In January, he did something similar. When Netanyahu's plea deal came up, he was very clear that he wanted to be leader of the Likud. He also called for these primaries back last fall, when it was clear that Netanyahu was the person who prevented a right religious government from coming to power after the fourth election. Will the primary happen? Unclear, because while Netanyahu has a lot of clashes with the leadership in the Knesset, the actual parliamentarians, he has a lot of strong support from the party's voter base, as well as its central committee. And the Likud central committee plays a really key role in the party in terms of determining its leadership, its direction, etc. What's interesting to say, though, is that Edelstein's remarks were made on the back of two other developments. And one is what David mentioned, which was this discussion last week on really non-substantive issues about funding a scholarship program for IDF veterans, and a mini rebellion actually ensued in the Likud because of it, because so many Likud members did ideologically support this, and then in addition to the ideology, understood that it would be hard to explain to their voters why they wouldn't support legislation that helps soldiers, that they rebelled against Netanyahu and two other members of Likud leadership who said, no, we're going to oppose supporting this bill to fund this program, not because we don't agree with it, but because we will do anything we can to show that this government does not work. We can embarrass it and show that it's failing. Subsequent to that, the Likud really stood by this secondary position it's had that, oh no, the issue isn't the bill. It's that you're only funding it at 66%. We want a full funding for these scholarships, which in my opinion is a little bit beyond the pale of the issue, because this is a program that's been running since 2016. And it's always been 2/3 funded. The second thing that's really been a tailwind behind this idea of pushing Netanyahu aside has been its Haredi ally, United Torah Judaism, which has been increasingly vocal in the past few weeks about the need to either reconsider who the leader of the right should be, or suggesting very gently that the Likud should consider who the leader of its own party should be. And UTJ has been very careful not to make bold statements in this manner. But the fact that they're even raising these issues, albeit in a somewhat roundabout way, is really telling. And, you know, I spoke to sources within the party, and they've been very clear to me that their desire is to have a right religious government. And they see that the problem is the personality of Netanyahu, and either Netanyahu needs to do some relationship repair, or we need to find another way to have a right religious government led by someone who isn't so controversial.
David, piggyback off of this.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the arguments against Netanyahu was certainly an argument raised by Gideon Saar when he left Likud and set up New Hope, was that if after four elections, or it was three at the time, Netanyahu had been unable to build a government, he needed to step aside. He was refusing to step aside. Because he's a controversial figure, he was denying the right-wing majority in the public their ability to build a government. And that was one of the arguments that Saar made for bolting the Kurd, setting up another party so that the true will of the people would not be derailed by the antipathy to Netanyahu. I just think something has probably changed now, and I don't want to be making predictions here. But okay, so now there was another government in power for a year, and it didn't have Netanyahu. And I suspect that a proportion of the Israeli electorate will say to itself, as and when it is next asked to vote, okay, so we gave, you know, basically everybody else a chance. There were eight parties in the last coalition. What a bunch of incompetence they turned out to be. Yeah, some of us really don't like Netanyahu, but I suspect, in other words, that there might be a little further swing in Netanyahu's direction. And I also think within Likud, they may have a sense that kind of momentum has moved back towards Netanyahu. His trial isn't going terribly well for the prosecution. The Bennett-led coalition proved a bust. And therefore, I think the prospect of Netanyahu making a grand return, it's a little better than it was not too many weeks ago.
We'll take a short break now. Hi, podcast listeners. The Times of Israel is celebrating a decade this year, and I'm happy to invite you to our kickoff TOI at 10 live event series. Join us May 24th at Jerusalem's First Station for Who by Fire, Leonard Cohen and the Yom Kippur War. Author Matti Friedman will be in conversation with TOI editor David Horvitz to discuss his new book on the singer-priest's extraordinary tour for IDF troops in 1973. And of course, there will be live music. If you're in Israel, please join us. If you're not, we'll share a recording after the event exclusively with our TOI community members. For more information and tickets, go to timesofisrael.com/TOI10. That's timesofisrael.com/TOI10. Hope to see you there.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie.
their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. As you mentioned, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still having his day in court, but stuff is happening in the case, in Case 4000, especially after shaky testimony from state's witness Shlomo Filber. But there are still a lot of people who are saying, hey, this is a former prime minister who is still in court. Maybe he's not the best candidate. In any case, Carrie, what is happening right now in terms of the case?
Yeah, so the case is ongoing. As you said, it will be ongoing for quite some time. Let's just frame this with there are many more witnesses. There's much more testimony to come. But what has been billed as one of the state's key witnesses, Shlomo Filber. He has increasingly shown himself to be, if not unreliable, his testimony has a lot of questions about it. And over the past 2 weeks, two serious holes were poked in the prosecution's theory of the bribery case in Case 4000, which alleges that Netanyahu directed Filber to exchange some very lucrative benefits to telecommunications giant Bezeq in exchange for positive media coverage in the Walla newspaper, both of which were under Elovich's control. The two things in question, one was the timing of a supposed meeting between Netanyahu and Filber, where he allegedly instructed Filber to trade these benefits. And the second thing in question was the content of this meeting. The prosecution, the first of which the defense really successfully showed that the date in which the prosecution alleges the meeting could have happened didn't happen. They used cell phone location data to show it was really big embarrassment for the prosecution. The prosecution had to file an updated indictment last Sunday. That was a problem. And the second was that Netanyahu's lawyer really succeeded in showing that the notes from a meeting that Filber apparently had with Netanyahu didn't necessarily prove that Netanyahu instructed Filber to do anything. He just showed an alternative theory to what could happen. And this is important under Israeli law because the standard is so high for proving what in the U.S. you would call reasonable doubt. And in fact, this was a really interesting feature of the legal system here. That a former senior lawyer in the prosecutor's office helped me understand. In the United States, criminal trials are by a jury panel, and the standard is reasonable doubt, which is a pretty high standard. In Israel, it's a panel of judges, and the standard is also that common law standard of reasonable doubt. But when you have judges who are deciding upon it, that doubt needs to be justified and articulated to a much higher standard than a lay jury would need to, especially because it's in a written opinion. It's explained in a written opinion, and that opinion is then subject to appeal.
And it's just one of many cases that he has.
Yeah, it's one of many, but it's the most serious of the many, of the three. It's the only one with a bribery charge. It was when Netanyahu was, his lawyers were discussing a possible plea bargain towards the end of the term of the previous attorney general. That was the case that they would have wanted to have the bribery charge get negotiated away in a plea bargain. So I think Netanyahu is feeling that the bribery charge against him has been, you know, significantly weakened in the last few days. And since that's the worst charge, the notion that he feels the need for a plea bargain at all is receding all the time. He was you know, manifestly extremely happy at the end of that day's testimony last week. And he's been going to court. He didn't attend many, many weeks of the trial, but he's been in court for the defense cross-examination of Filber, and he's been leaving the courtroom very, very happy.
We will just close out with a bit of a preview of a live event that we're going to hold on Tuesday night. Can you believe we're having a live event, David, to begin with?
I think it's a wonderful thing. Yes, the fact that it's a nice event is a real bonus, but just simply the fact that, please God, we'll be getting together in Jerusalem in person with a nice crowd of Times of Israel readers, and I love the event. is wonderful.
It should be a great event at the Tachana Rishona, the first station in Jerusalem, in basically an indoor-outdoor kind of situation. So people who are a little worried about coronavirus still should be perhaps a little less worried. But David, you should tell us about the event, because there'll be you on stage with author Mati Friedman talking about Mati's new book, Who by Fire.
Hopefully it'll be lovely. It's me interviewing Mati Friedman. He wrote a book about Leonard Cohen's, I don't know how many people who are not huge Leonard Cohen fans or consumers of even the most remote news items would know, but Leonard Cohen came to Israel in 1973 during the Yom Kippur War and played for the troops. But he didn't play for the troops kind of Bob Hope style in a big, you know, base somewhere in the heart of the safe territory. No, he played for troops on the front lines. He crossed the Suez Canal not long after the IDF had crossed the Suez Canal into Egypt in sort of the crucial crossing of the war. He took immense personal risk. How was that allowed to happen? Because it was war and it was chaotic. And by the way, he wasn't a global superstar at the time. So it's really interesting. Why did he choose to come here? We'll talk about who Leonard Cohen was in terms of his Jewishness, in terms of his Jewish prophet. His Jewish priestliness, as well as his singer-songwriting-ness, which are all of a piece, obviously. And what's also, there's a second element that I think is so interesting to Mati's book, which is not only does he document this beyond surreal, quote-unquote, concert tour. I mean, it was just not what that usually brings to mind. But he also argues that the 73 war was such a turning point for Israel. I don't think that's, you know, an original or radical argument. But he talks about how after 73, Israel kind of became a bit more Leonard Cohen-ish, including in its culture, in terms of its, you know, this secular, indomitable state that thought that it was, you know, undefeatable, that was so confident, and that was the product of the secular Zionist pioneers. After Yom Kippur, the degree to which we became a more God-fearing and religious nation, or at least that narrative became more central. And like, as Mati puts it, that we, you know, that even the secular artists became a bit more religious in their themes. And we'll talk about that and some of the specifics. But the country as a whole, you know, this radical shift kind of emblemized by Leonard Cohen. I just think it's fascinating. And hopefully lots of people listening to this will join us on Tuesday evening.
I look forward to seeing you and everyone there on Tuesday night. And thank you, both of you, for joining me today.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing, and thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time,
Shalom.